Drop your socks and grab your pencils and look up. Here comes the colonel.
Yes, yes, yes. That's absolutely correct. Pay attention. A lot of important stuff coming your direction. Welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. This half hour, we're back with Gary Hill, the senior research scientist and chief astronomer at the McDonald Observatory with the University of Texas at Austin. Gary is the principal investigator of HETDEX, that's H-E-T-D-E-X, the Hobby Eberle Telescope Dark Energy Project. Dark energy, you know, that mysterious force that's causing the universe's expansion to speed up. Dark energy has been called the greatest problem in all of science today. So a couple of years ago, Gary's group introduced a new instrument called VIRUS, Visible Integral Field Replicable Unit Spectrograph. It's studying a map for evidence of bionic acoustic oscillations. That's the pattern, I'm told, of sound waves imprinted on the universe at a very early time in the Big Bang. And we want to know how things have progressed since that instrument was introduced a couple of years ago. And what surprises, if any, has come about because of this new equipment? So, anyway, we're going to check in with Gary on that. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And right now, though, we want to step over to our fountain of useless information we have right here on the set. We're so lucky to have it. The fountain of useless information to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Okay, oh spirit of the fountain, today we've got a real stumper. What Argentinian was buried in a Milan cemetery under the pseudonym Maria Maggi? Maria Maggi.
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
Surprise answer here, huh? What Argentinian was buried in a Milan cemetery under the pseudonym of Maria Maggi? Well, so that's what happened to Eva Perón. Today, our guest is Dr. Gary Hill. He's senior research scientist and chief astronomer at the McDonald Observatory. And when we broke last hour, we were talking about the new instrument that they introduced a couple of years ago called VIRUS, Visible Integral Field Replicable Unit Spectrograph. And what developments have happened since the introduction of that? If I were to ask you this week if you get any surprises, or any this month, you get any surprise? What surprises are we talking about?
What it does is it actually puts 33,000 fibers onto the sky simultaneously. And as a result, we're actually looking at the universe in a brand new way. Normally what you do is you might take an image with the Hubble Space Telescope or telescopes on the ground, and you select, oh, well, that's an interesting galaxy to look at, or I want to look at that star because perhaps it's a very, very old star. It might be unenriched with metals, for instance, from the very early phases of the universe. And then what you would do is you would put a fiber or a slit on it with a spectrograph and then analyze that data. But what you've done is you've pre-selected that object to look at. We go completely blind. So as a result, it's hard to predict what we will find this year. We can actually be sure that we are going to find some of the very, very oldest stars in our galaxy, from the first one or two generations of stars in our own galaxy. If we just look out through the halo of our galaxy, they're going to be hiding in there. They couldn't be found any other way. We're going to essentially look at all of the star formation going way back in time. And we're going to, I think we have a good picture of that right now, but we're going to test it at a much higher level. So we can predict things like that, but as you say, there's going to be something new, and every time in astronomy that we've brought a new observational technique to bear on the problem, like we are with VIRUS, something really unexpected crops up. And we're expecting the unexpected, even though that sounds a bit trite.
What are some of the unexpected things that cropped up in the past? Can you give us an example?
Oh, some good examples. Let's see. Well, one of the great ones was the discovery of gamma ray bursts. And now, people know about these a bit now because there are satellites up there looking for them. But the very first detection was made by a system of satellites put up by during the Cold War to monitor the Test Ban Treaty. So they were expecting, if anyone was doing nuclear tests, that there would be essentially pulses of gamma rays being emitted and they would detect them. But it turned out that about every day they detected a very, very sharp burst of gamma rays from out in the universe. And, well, they very quickly realized it wasn't coming from the Earth, and so they deduced it was from the universe. And that was decades ago. Subsequently, it took a very long time to sort of hone in on what they were. But in the end, it turned out that they are being emitted from galaxies way, way across the universe. And what they're now thought to be are very, very energetic exploding stars that may actually direct a pulse of gamma rays essentially along two polar axes, and sometimes those are pointed at us and we see the flash. So that's one of those really unexpected things. Other ones come from when radio telescopes antennae was first used and trained on the sky. Turned out that there was a galaxy we call Cygnus A that was enormously bright in the radio and is actually known now to have a huge supermassive black hole at its center and is essentially acting like an enormous particle accelerator and spewing tight jets of matter out in a way well away from the galaxy. Things like that. So essentially any time you have a new technique, something new turns up. And of course, Hubble Space Telescope has really delivered in that way on many, many fronts, such as the star-forming regions where they found these sort of huge pillars of dust and gas that are forming stars at their apexes and things like that. So we're very excited to be sort of pioneering this new observation method.
Now, some of the stars that you've observed, maybe many of them, do you think they may no longer exist? I mean, you're seeing them millions of years ago. Do you think some of them might have disappeared by now?
Oh, well, absolutely, almost certainly. So when we're looking at a galaxy 10 billion years ago, one of these ones that we detect, we're actually seeing them because they're forming stars vigorously. And we know that when you form stars vigorously, you make some number of really massive stars. And we know in very great detail how stars evolve, and the more massive ones use up their fuel much more quickly and really only a matter of 100 million years or so, whereas our Sun, which is much less massive, is already about 4.5 billion years old and is about halfway through its lifetime. So essentially what happens is that the more massive stars will essentially, the most massive ones will explode really pretty quickly, and they will make these supernova explosions. And essentially what that does is it throws gas out into the galaxy that has been enriched with iron and carbon and lots of other things, all the way up to uranium. And essentially that enriches the medium, the gaseous medium of the galaxy. And from that material, you form the next generation of stars. So each time the amount of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and these other things goes up. And by the time you get to the era when our solar system was formed, where our star formed, in fact, it was quite highly enriched. And as a result, all of that material ended up in the Earth and from which we are made. And so you know for a fact that there have been many, many generations of stars just because we're here.
So as one star goes down and another star goes down, it creates new gaseous material that goes out and creates new solar systems and planets and suns and that sort of thing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And essentially you have to have this process where these explosions are very violent and they throw all of this enriched material. Because right in the center of stars, they turn hydrogen into helium and then into carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and then when they explode, they make even heavier elements. And so not only do they make the elements, but they throw them out at great speed, a lot of energy, and actually then disperse them out into the gas and enrich it. And the more it gets enriched, the more material there is to make planets like our own. exploration.
Wow, fascinating stuff. I guess we should say the Hobby-Eberle Telescope is a joint project of the University of Texas at Austin and the Pennsylvania State University, Stanford University, and some places in Germany. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. That is right. Yes, yes. There's actually Göttingen and Munich in Germany have been major part of this from the beginning, and the HETDEX project also adds institutions in Potsdam and another one in Munich. To the roster, and they're joining really because they're extremely interested in the data set that we're going to produce, and so it isn't really just dark energy. There's once you start surveying huge areas of sky blind like this, there's all kinds of interesting science you can do.
So you're all together to discover these things, but I understand there's a race between different projects around the world to crack the mystery of dark energy. And can you explain who the other players are and how your project stacks up?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, actually, obviously, when you start making statements like this is one of the most important questions in the whole of physics, then it gets people's interest. And there are a number of initiatives, and some of them very, very large and on longer time frames, being contemplated to make these kinds of precision measurements of the universe that we need to unravel dark energy. And the longer scale ones involve major satellites that the Europeans and NASA and DOE are contemplating putting up on about a decade time frame. And then extremely large radio telescope is probably more like the 20-year time frame. But in the short term, it's really ground-based optical observatories that are coming to bear on this. And so, as I said, there's three projects going forward right now. Ourselves, HETDEX, who are looking back in time at the question. And then there is this BOSS project, which is run by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Consortium, using a telescope in New Mexico at Apache Point. And then there's the Dark Energy Survey, which is actually going to modify a 4-meter telescope at the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile by putting a very, very large sort of billion-pixel camera onto that telescope and then image a very large area of sky and use a number of methods to look at dark energy in the recent past. So BOSS and the Dark Energy Survey are looking at the recent evolution of dark energy, or how strong it is today, looking back maybe sort of 5 or 6 or 7 billion years. We're looking much further back in time, and between the three we get very good leverage on the properties of dark energy going way back in time. We're actually right now, in terms of completing our survey, we are a nose ahead, you might say. BOSS has actually started, but takes a longer period to do their observations. The Dark Energy Survey deploys in about the same time we do, in about a year and a half. Because of the power of the virus instrument, we get to finish our observing in about 3 years, which sort of puts us a nose ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of really understanding dark energies, these experiments are extremely complementary. And so it'll take the combination of all three of them to really give the definitive picture.
So it's a worldwide effort, and really to come to the depth of the answers to these questions.
Yes, very, very much so. And as I said, sort of initiatives, once you go into space, it's very expensive, and these satellites are looking at sort of billion-dollar level investments, and the radio telescope, the Square Kilometer Array I mentioned, is on the several billion-dollar level. We, on the other hand, are actually, of all of the initiatives going forward, the least expensive. Our entire project to deploy is $34 million, which is several tens of million less than BOSS and the DES survey that we're competing against here. And it's partly because we are we're a small group. We have a very unique resource with the Hobby-Eberle Telescope, which is the third largest telescope in the world, but is essentially run by a small consortium. And it was relatively easy to convince the members of that consortium to let us essentially reinvent their telescope and put this massive instrument on it. It's a bit harder to do that with the other sort of nationally and internationally run 10-meter, 8-meter class telescopes. And so we have a fortunate sort of niche position here where we get to try out some things and do it in a really relatively inexpensive way.
And the telescope itself, the McDonald Telescope, the University of Texas at Austin, but it's the telescope itself is really located where?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Austin's sort of what you call Central Texas, and we like to say the observatory's in far west Texas, and anytime you've driven there, you realize how big Texas is. It is out in the Davis Mountains near the Big Bend National Park, and it's about a seven-hour drive from Austin to get there. So it's very remote. It's a very dark site. It's arguably the darkest site in the U.S. It's a very very good site for the particular technical configuration of the Hobby Ebbeli telescope, and allows us to run it very inexpensively, and we constructed it very inexpensively as well. So it's a great site. You feel miles from anywhere, and it's incredible how dark the skies are out there.
And you travel then quite a bit back between Austin and there, I guess, is that right? Or do you go out there for several months at a time?
Yeah, well, we tend to it goes in waves. When we're doing some major instrument work like we are here, we'll go out there for months sometimes. Typically, a couple of times a month, make the trip out there. Students of mine go out and observe typically once a month, and so yeah, we have a strong presence going back and forth. And it's actually it's not a bad drive if you've got a companion to talk to, and you can actually get a lot of work done.
I guess. All right. Well, getting back to something that you said before that really is fascinating to me, and I know to our listeners, is that the solar system that we're in right at the moment, the sun and the planets and us and everything else, was all then the creation of multiple or at least one star or something blowing up and sending out all this energy and all this matter and all these other things that later formed into these gaseous clouds and then formed into what we have right now. That's what you said. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And many generations of stars are needed to create what we have now in our solar system.
So we're actually talking about creation. And what created the original stars then? I mean, how did that come about?
Well, right. So early on in the Big Bang, there was a very, very hot phase where basically the universe was so hot that you couldn't actually have hydrogen atoms. So you had protons, which are the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, and electrons, which are buzzing around the protons in the hydrogen. They were actually separating because there was enough energy to keep them apart. And so you had this plasma. And that plasma essentially lasted for about 300,000 years until the expansion of the universe cooled off the universe to the point where it was about the temperature of the surface of our sun, and the hydrogen, the electrons could combine them with the protons and make hydrogen atoms to appear. And that's the point at which you sort of started having sort of gas as we currently know it. So the hydrogen and helium were made in the Big Bang, and there's also some predictions about exactly the ratio of helium to hydrogen that come out of Big Bang theory that are actually borne out by our observations of the universe as well. So that's another piece of evidence for the Big Bang. But then it took a long time, essentially on the order of the best part of a billion years, for that gas to kind of coalesce together by gravitational attraction, and to the point where you could form the first stars. Now, this is an active area of research, both on the theoretical side and soon on the observational side, when we launch the James Webb Space Telescope, the next generation space telescope, which is really aimed at trying to see these very first stars, probe into what we call the Dark Ages, before there were a lot of stars in the universe. And we think that these stars were extremely massive, hundreds and hundreds of times the mass of the Sun, because of them forming out of very pristine hydrogen and helium material. And they would have gone through their lives extremely rapidly and exploded. And so, essentially, this activity then went through several generations until the other elements, like carbon and nitrogen and the other things we're made out of, began to build up sufficiently that these specially enormous stars didn't form anymore. And then it turned into what type of star formation that we can study today in our own galaxy. And so, essentially, those first stars were in the first billion or so, well, after the first billion years of the universe. And so the universe is 13.7 billion years old. So the galaxies that we're going to be looking at in Hetdex are about 11 or so billion years back in time. So we're talking only 3 billion years after the Big Bang there. And by then, they actually had enriched the heavy elements a fair amount. And so they don't look like our own galaxy in terms of the amounts of carbon and other heavy elements, but they're pretty enriched. And so even by then, you've gone through quite a few generations of stars.
Well, if we look at space as endless and empty and a vacuum with this expanding universes going all different directions, so space is nothing, and these other things are something. How does that hold with any sort of religious theories or anything about a creator? When you guys get together over a couple of drinks and start talking about where all this stuff came from, do you have an answer, or are you a particular religion, or how do you answer that?
Well, yes, I think that when you're doing science, it's all about asking questions and asking for proof. And I think by definition, religion is something where you believe and you accept something. And I have a lot of respect for all the religions of the world. I tend to think that you can quite happily be religious and do science. The thing is, though, that when we go out and test, we have a theory, we test it, we gain evidence for it, and as we push further and further back in time into our theory of the Big Bang, we do sort of get very close to this sort of moment of creation, you might say. We have no theory as to why that happened. We can explain the what happened in more and more detail as we progress in science, but we still don't have an answer to the why. Essentially, our understanding of physics is not sufficient yet to even start making conjectures about the about what the you might call the genesis of the universe was. So I'm very happy to leave that ambiguous at the moment. Anyway, I think that it's good to for everybody to have open minds about each other's interests and beliefs, and I think science can offer an awful lot to society and to everybody in terms of philosophy as well as just providing hard facts.
Well, Gary Hill, the senior research scientist and chief astronomer with the University of Texas at Austin's McDonald Observatory, you've been absolutely a fascinating guest, and I can't tell you how much I really appreciate you being with us today.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your viewers.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I would say, although it might sound cliche, what I would encourage people that feel that they have a way of doing something even just slightly better. It doesn't have to be revolutionary on day one or totally new, but if you have a way of doing things slightly better than are currently done, and you feel that you have the fire to go start a business, I say you go do it. You won't regret it. Even if it doesn't go as planned, the learnings you'll have for the rest of your life. So my only regret was that I didn't start when I was, 17. Should have. That's Ramon Nunez from Boulder.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
Waiting for you.